Well, can I welcome you? Welcome to this evening as we ask the question, could life in this world be different? My name's Andrew. I'm a member of the leadership team here at the church. And I wonder if you could please put your hands together for our interviewed couple, Jim and Sarah Horton. This evening's going to run in two halves. I'm going to interview these two now, then we're going to take a short break and then a talk after the break. Now, we had last night a High Court judge. Tomorrow night we have an Oxford professor. And in all possible respect, we're advertising you two as neither of those. You are a normal London couple. So, of course, you're not normal. You're interesting your own way. But we're hoping that you've got a story that we can all relate to, that you have experiences much like some of us, although a little bit later you'll be talking about some of your experiences of suffering in this world. Tell us, though, to help us get to know you, tell us a little bit about how you got together. And Jim, I understand that in your gap year, you climbed the highest mountain in South America, and you thought that mountains would be a good feature in your courtship. Tell us about that.
So a couple of moments stand out. One was the idea when we got engaged was that we would climb Mont Blanc. And Sarah had never climbed a kind of big mountain before, so the idea was that I would be a kind of, the strong man leading her up. And at the top, I would get down on one knee and propose. But actually, as it happened, she was fine and very strong, and I was feeling very nauseous and kind of vomiting. So I got to the top, and I thought in between vomits wasn't really the time to get down on one knee. But Sarah was fine. I remember she was chatting away at the top. So that didn't work. And then the other time I remember was when we... It was just after that, I think, and we went to the local climbing wall, and she'd never done rock climbing before. And I'm a climbing instructor, so I should know what I'm doing, really. But she was climbing, and she fell. And, of course, the key thing is you're not supposed to let go of the rope. But I was so terrified, because I think I loved her so much.
No.
I let go to kind of do that. But she was about 10 foot above me and just fell straight into my arms. So I dropped her on our first climb.
But we're still married, so, yeah.
But she said yes.
Yeah.
She said yes. She said yes. And she went through it.
And Sarah, tell us a bit about your story with Christian faith, because I understand that Jim, while you were at university, played quite a role in that. But start a bit further back. Tell us about playing hockey and church and how you started off.
So I went to a really nice local village church growing up, and I think I kind of slightly missed the point, and I think a lot of our youth group did, and we just had a really nice time hanging out together and went to youth club. And so then when I went to university, kind of I met these Christians who all seemed a bit hardcore and they took things a bit too seriously, and things seemed to clash. There's a lot to do at university, and hockey, I got quite into hockey, and that was on a Sunday morning, and church was on a Sunday morning. So church.
When you say you got quite into hockey, you were quite into it, you were the captain of the team.
Well, yeah, so I was captain of the ice hockey team, and which is a great excuse, therefore, to have to be at training on a Sunday morning and therefore not be at church.
And you took the title off, the intervarsity title for the first time in 10 years. Okay, so you were quite into hockey.
I was quite into hockey, that is true. Which therefore meant that, I just didn't really go to church after a while. But there were a few people who were really great in kind of prodding me and trying to read the Bible with me, and I didn't quite understand why they were taking it so seriously. And then towards the end of my time there, I met Jim, and we started having some good fights about the fact that I thought I was a Christian and Jim thought I wasn't a Christian. And I think I came to eventually realise that... I think then we started having some debates about things that were just a bit irrelevant. And Jim came out with a line at one point where he said something like that it's not about whether you like God or whether you like how he does things. It's about whether he is God and whether you believe in him. And I think that kind of struck a chord at that point, and I realized that I couldn't just decide Jesus died, I'm fine, let's move on with life. That actually, if Jesus died and if God was real, that was important, and I had to do something with that, and I had to stop living my life doing what I wanted to do and start living for Jesus, living for God.
It's amazing. I Sorry, I knew that she was serious because there's a big book called The Cross of Christ by John Stott, which is about this thick. And I remember I kind of challenged her in the summer and said, I bet you, read this. And about 3 days later, she'd read it. So I thought, she must like me. It must be all right. We're okay.
Okay, well, let me push on that, because maybe people think, Christianity, it's just what people want to believe. You're just persuading yourself, wishful thinking. And in particular, you like a boy, he wants you to be a Christian, you persuade yourself. You work as an engineer,
yep.
So you're a sort of rational, scientific, calculating kind of person. What persuades you that your faith isn't just wishful thinking?
I think it's easy to kind of use the scientific excuse and say, like, well, evolution, big bang, like you use all the kind of buzzwords of why kind of it contradicts your faith. But I think it's never really felt like a contradiction to me, I think, because I guess the way I see it is fundamentally the Christian faith is about whether you believe that Jesus died, or Jesus lived, Jesus died, and Jesus rose. And as far as I'm convinced, the historical evidence and the scientific evidence is there. And I trust that, and therefore you can get hung up in the technicalities of kind of other scientific complications, which I don't fully understand, but clever Christian scientists do. But I think if you look into, I looked into the resurrection and whether that was really true, and there's just so much compelling evidence that is true, that everything else kind of fades into the background until you've dealt with that, I think.
Let me ask sort of same kind of question for you, Jen. Now, I know you are from a very keen Christian background. You told me that your parents read the Bible with you every day for the first 12 years of your life before you became a 12, then 13 was teenage years, and you got a bit rebellious. But you had this very strong Christian influence, and now you were a teacher in a Highgate school, now you work in a school in southeast London as a chaplain. So what if somebody would say to you, look, it's obvious you were brainwashed as a child, and now you're brainwashing other children. You're a chaplain in a school, persuading them what to believe. What would you say?
Good question. I think it's funny, isn't it, how you remember these things, but I remember at about 13 being desperate for it not to be true, because I was desperate for it to not have to follow it. So I wanted everything that my parents kind of stood for, I wanted to reject, as often you do as a 13-year-old boy. And so I remember saying I didn't believe it and really wanting it not to be true. So I don't think, what do I know, but I don't think therefore that's brainwashing, because I was really looking for almost the opposite. And I think I came back to it really a bit later through some friends and people who lent me various books and a bit like Sarah, looking into the evidence for it. Though I think my parents, I think they read the Bible with me, but also they lived a Christian life, and what they said and what they did kind of were compatible. And that, I think, must have been quite deep within me, even though I was desperate to kind of shrug it off as a teenage boy. So I don't think I was brainwashed as a child, but obviously I can't prove that. But then in terms of what I do now, I think one of the things that I'm doing as a chaplain, the kind of thing we talk about is dialogue. So asking people questions and just getting to think about big questions in life. And particularly, I think, striking at the moment that I think often people aren't aware of almost a brainwashing from another source. So people are, everyone has a particular point of view, and there's a quite strong undercurrent, kind of secular thought, that lots of people are pushing on these kids at school. They're not saying to them, we're trying to convert you to our brand of secularism or whatever. They're just that's the way their beliefs are couched. And so I think almost they're brainwashed into that. And all I'm trying to do in chaplaincy is say, are you sure that's the case? Does that really provide the answers that mean something to you? Does that explain the way the world works? So, I think that's what I'd say. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. Now, we're addressing various questions during this week. Could life in this world be different? And the topic for tonight is hope in a suffering world. And part of the reason we've got you here tonight is that the last 2 years haven't been the easiest in your life. Sarah, do you want to tell us a bit about the story of what happened and how the story unfolded?
Yeah. So last autumn, so kind of 18 months ago-ish, I found a lump in my neck and kind of was young and healthy and assumed it was nothing, and mentioned it to Jim's mum, who's a GP, and she said, oh, it's probably nothing, but you should probably get it checked. And I went to the GP, and they said, it's probably nothing, but we'll send you for a scan. And so it kind of, I went through various referrals. And then there was 1 week where I had, so I was pregnant at the time, and we had our 12-week scan for our second child on, I think it was, I can't remember what day, one day in the week. And that was all really fine, and the baby seemed really healthy. So that was a great emotional high point. And then I think it was about 2 days later, I went to the follow-up appointment after my ultrasound biopsy of this lump. And even that consultant had been so convinced that there was nothing to worry about that he hadn't looked at the results before we came into the room. So we kind of came into the room and sat down in the chair, and there's this kind of slightly, there's one of those pauses that was just kind of slightly too long, that it was just a little bit awkward. And then he turned around and he said, I'm sorry, this is not what I was expecting. And I think that kind of summed up our feeling about the whole situation.
You said that the night before you'd spoken to Jim's uncle, who's an oncologist.
He's a surgeon, and so he kind of knows all sorts of medical stuff. And he just mentioned in a conversation with Jim that, you know, lymphoma is a bad word, lipoma is a good word when you're talking about neck lumps. So just kind of, I think just preparing us just in case. But it was always just in case. And then, this consultant said that I had Hodgkin's lymphoma, and that was obviously the bad word. And, and then it kind of went from there, I guess. But he, so on the plus side, he said that if you're gonna have cancer, that's, you know, that's the kind to get, is the way it kept being billed. Like, it had a good prognosis, it had a good, like, they have things they can do treatment-wise, but I was 12 weeks pregnant, and it was, yeah, completely out of the blue as far as we were concerned at that point.
And obviously, well, people know that with cancer, there's often chemotherapy and radiotherapy and these pretty aggressive treatments. But being pregnant made it quite a lot more complicated. So tell us a bit about how that
It affected
works.
The timings. So, like, you can't have, you know, soft cheese and wine, but it turns out you can have certain types of chemotherapy when you're pregnant, which is great, as it turns out. But
then you reflect on the dangers of calendar.
It does. It makes you more inclined to have some cheese. But they had to wait until, I think, about 16 to 20 weeks, because for the first chunk, the baby does all the, like, getting of limbs and hearts and everything, and then after kind of 16, 20 weeks, it's just growing. So they wait until that point, because then, in theory, the kind of vague papers they had about it were saying it shouldn't have any serious effect. So then I had 4 months of chemotherapy, which then finished at when I was 36 weeks pregnant. So they timed it so that then I could have 2 weeks to get all the drugs out of my system, then have the baby.
Because you basically don't want the drugs on the other side of the placenta when the baby's
Yeah,
born.
So they can handle all sorts of things when they're in there, but if he was born kind of with all the chemotherapy drugs in him, then I think that was going to be a problem, because he, poor little, his, I think his liver couldn't handle it, whereas mine could. So as long as it was all going through my system, then he was going to be all right. And he was born perfectly healthy. Lovely little baby Josh. And then they gave us 4 weeks to kind of recover from having had a baby and get the hang of having had a baby. And then they did 2 weeks off. And then they had radiotherapy for 17 days after that. And at the end of that, I had a scan which seemed to show everything had all been blitzed. And yeah, as far as we're aware at the moment, I am lymphoma free, which is excellent. And Josh is still very healthy, which is cool.
Now, people might ask you, like, you believe in God, you think God's good, but he's put you through this. Why do you think he's good when you've experienced these awful things?
To me.
Yeah, why not? Yeah. Well, both of you, but you still have.
That's a good question. I think because I don't think our kind of view of God's goodness hinges on how we experience life, because that's not what the Bible tells us to expect. The Bible makes it pretty clear throughout that the world is in a mess in all sorts of ways, and actually that we should expect suffering of all sorts of kinds, from lots of angles. And you think about the world today, and you know, I think we had it pretty easy in some ways compared with lots and lots of people in the world. So I don't think it hinges on, I don't think our view of God's goodness hinges on what we experience necessarily in that way. And also, the thing we kept going back to last year was that we know he's good because he sent his son to die for us. So in some ways, the objective thing you can look back to is whatever you feel. And there were some pretty low moments last year. And I think, there's all sorts of things on that. But when those low moments come and you kind of, your feelings say, this can't be right, there must be something wrong here, God can't be wanting this to happen, then we look back and we said, we know he loves us because Jesus died for us. And that is it's an objective sign of love. So we know he's good. And we know that he says, look, life's going to be tough.
Jesus died for you, but you still get cancer. So what difference does Jesus' death make to you practically?
I think you can just trust that, or as we found that we could trust that God knew what he was doing. And partly even partly the fact that you experience rubbish stuff, which kind of you read about in the Bible, like it matches up, makes you trust God more in the sense that it kind of backs up what he said is the world's going to be like. Therefore, you're like, okay, well, this is what you said the world's going to be like. So that is another reason to trust you, not another reason to distrust you. And therefore, I think I found that quite helpful, like knowing that God knows better than me. God, if I can't make the world, I can't come up with an amazing plan to send Jesus to save people. Like my intellect and ability is like that, and God's is like that. And so actually being able to trust that God was looking after this little baby who I had absolutely no control over when these drugs were going in, it was really comforting, I think. And actually I think there were moments where I doubted his goodness because it seemed really unfair on this poor child. But I think when it came down to it, just being able to trust that God loved this little baby, God had made this little baby, and therefore I could trust God to know what the best thing for that little baby was really reassuring and comforting. And ultimately, I think it's hard to think about it, but ultimately, if it was for that baby not to make it, or for me not to make it, or whatever, that God is in charge of that, and God has a better plan for that, and we're promised this amazing future where there is no pain and no suffering and no chemotherapy and no anything horrible in life because God has made this amazing, perfect world for us if we trust in him. And that is a really good, amazing God that we have to follow.
Jimmy, when I asked you about this earlier, you wanted to go on the front foot. So that was your defence as a Christian. And then what was your reply to the sceptic or the atheist?
Well, so I think last year we were more aware than ever, really, together. Well, I mean, it brought us together, didn't it, as a couple and as a family. But also we were aware that we really relied on having a heavenly father whose hand we were holding the whole time. And, you know, I think we prayed like we've never prayed before. And there was kind of depths of relationship last year that we've never had before. And I think I did think, genuinely, what do you do if you don't believe? What do you do if you don't know God as your Heavenly Father in those situations? If it is random and there's no one who's planning it, even if you don't quite understand the plan sometimes, I just thought it must be pretty terrifying. The thing that that always gets me, and we've got a scan next week, a kind of follow-up scan, so in some ways we're slightly on tenterhooks again at the moment because the last time we had a scan was last June, and now we're a year on, and so we're hoping that it's clear, but I think we're rethinking those things again. And it's just a phone call away, isn't it? You get the scan, then you get an email 3 or 4 days later, whatever it is, and the email says, please come in and talk to us, and then you go in, and they could say anything. And your life hinges on those moments, and you know, it's so fragile. That was, I think, what we learned last year. You could go home now, and as you go to bed, you suddenly brush your hand on your neck and you find a lump, and that's it. And I just found that pretty terrifying. And I was so glad that that I could rely on a God who loved us and was good and was planning the whole thing, much as we didn't understand bits of it, and that there was a certain future. I mean, all those things is amazing, and I don't know how I'd do it if it wasn't true.
Thank you very much, Jim and Sarah Horton. We're going to take a 5-minute break now just to get more drinks or make yourself comfortable, and then a talk will follow. Thank you. Let me call us back together. Let's make a start. Well, I'm grateful for Jim and Sarah for being so honest in that interview, and I deliberately gave them quite a hard time because I know they're very thought-through people on this question of suffering. I guess people come to a talk like this perhaps for a couple of different reasons. It might be that for you it's just a matter of philosophical interest, that classically for philosophers the problem of evil or the theodicy is one of the hardest nuts to crack, and particularly they know that it's one of the hardest questions for the Christian. And it might be that you've come just out of a kind of intellectual curiosity, or maybe even just to watch me wince as I try to wriggle out of the conundrum. The Scottish philosopher David Hume once said, a sceptic himself, "Were a stranger to drop of a sudden into this world, I would show him as a specimen of its ills, a nation languishing under famine, tyranny, or pestilence, a fleet foundering in an ocean, a hospital crowded with diseases, a prison filled with malefactors and debtors." And he goes on to say that he finds it impossible to square the reality of suffering in this world with any ultimate purpose of good. The way the argument's often put is like this: if God were all-powerful, he would be able to end suffering. If God were all-loving, he would want to end suffering. But here's manifestly a world filled with all kinds of suffering. So an all-powerful, all-loving God cannot exist. And at which point the philosopher sits down in his or her armchair and watches the Christian wriggle. Maybe you're here for some entertainment of that kind. But other people are perhaps at a talk like this because the question of suffering for you isn't just a theoretical one or a third-hand one. It might be that people in this room are suffering or know people that you love who are suffering. And this is a question that matters to you. And out of respect for people like that who will be here, I want us to address the question soberly and quite seriously. It's my job as a Christian minister. I've had quite an easy life, but I guess I've encountered other people suffering a bit more than the average. And some of it's been grim. I've taken funerals. I've visited people in their hospitals. I've seen people's relationships going badly, badly wrong. And suffering is grim. And it makes us ask the question, is there hope? Could there be a different kind of world? Could life in this world be different? Before I come to the teaching of Jesus, and I want to spend most of our time looking at that quite closely, I want to just survey some of the other answers to suffering on the shelves of the religious supermarket. Because while I don't believe that Christianity answers every question that we might have, in fact, Sarah was saying, there were points where she asked, why is it happening to me? And we don't always understand. But I am persuaded that although Christianity doesn't offer every answer, it does offer a much, much better answer than any of the alternatives. I just want to run through some of them, and why I find them so unsatisfactory. Let's begin with atheism, which was my own worldview. As a first-year science undergraduate at Cambridge, I was an atheist and a skeptic. And the atheist says about suffering, suffering is meaningless. Suffering is random. In fact, everything is meaningless. Everything is random. We came about by chance. We are no different from any other species, writes one French philosopher, as being a lucky throw in the cosmic lottery. And so all our suffering is the decrease or increase in the concentration of various neurochemicals into a randomly assembled collection of atoms, which we call our brain. And it's very difficult to see why it would matter. And the question why doesn't even make sense. I remember when we were bored in maths lessons at school, we had this is really sad, but we had a scientific calculator with all the extra functions on, and one of them was a random number generator. And we used to sometimes press it and then look at what number came out. I mean, that was how bored we were. And to ask the question, it was a 7, I wonder why it was a 7. No reason, it's just random. It could equally have been a 6 or a 3 or a 2 or a 1 or an 8. It's just meaningless. And so the atheist says suffering is meaningless, ultimately. Richard Dawkins, our favourite household name, atheist, he's in a world of blind physical forces and genetic replication. Some people are going to get hurt, some people are going to get lucky, and you won't find any rhyme or reason in it, nor any justice. The universe we observe has precisely the properties we expect. If there is at bottom no good, no evil, nothing but blind, pitiless indifference. And yet somehow that answer doesn't seem enough, does it? We all have a sense that the world ought not to be like it is. It ought to be better. I remember a friend of mine who's after a bacterial infection in his spine has been left in a wheelchair for life. He's my age, he was a very sporty guy, and now will have to use a wheelchair for the rest of his life. I remember him doing a talk about his own faith in God, and he said that the very expectation or the hope of something different, it implies a sense that this isn't the world the way the world ought to be. We're not satisfied. But of course the atheist says, well, you ought to be, because this is all there is. This is the way the world is, by chance, billions of years after it began, by chance. Atheism, suffering is meaningless. Hinduism, suffering is payback. That's obviously not the word that Hindus use. In fact, they use the more trendy word. It's become quite trendy in the West, any rate, karma. But basically, karma means payback. So by an endless cycle of reincarnation, you live your life over and over again, you get what's coming to you. What goes around comes around. And so you see somebody in a wheelchair or in a hospital, and basically you say, well, you're getting what you deserved. Last time round, you messed up. This time round, you suffer. It's all part of the cosmic balance, which is karma. A friend of mine who's a doctor and grew up in India, and she said that in her own culture, people were able to cope with the massive poverty people saw around them because they believed, well, really, people are just getting what they deserve. You're at the bottom of the pile. Well, it must be what you had coming to you. Everything is in balance. I'm not satisfied with that. To say to a suffering person, you deserved it, is not a very satisfying answer. In fact, you remember Glenn Hoddle, the England football captain, getting into such trouble a few years ago for saying precisely this, but only articulating a philosophy that millions of people in the world believe. Suffering is payback. Then you go across to Buddhism. You may know that Buddhism came about in part because the Buddha was wrestling with the question of suffering and how this world could be endured. And he came to the insight that we suffer because we form attachments to things. We care about things. And if only somehow we could break those attachments and stop caring, then we would free ourselves from suffering. And so the great goal of Buddhism is that emptiness and tranquility of nirvana. I used to be a neuroscientist before going into Christian ministry, and I used to enjoy those books by Oliver Sacks. Maybe some of you have come across them, the popular neuroscientist books in Waterstones. Titles like The Man Who Mistook His Wife for a Hat, and so on. He basically describes interesting brain damage cases. And in one of his books, he describes a man who was admitted to a Buddhist monastery in his 20s. And people were astonished at the incredible enlightenment that he had achieved at such an early age. Because whatever you did, he just stared out into the middle distance, completely detached from everything around him. You could click your fingers in his face and he would be unstirred by it. And they praised this great enlightenment. And then it was discovered he had a massive frontal lobe tumor, and essentially his higher cognitive functions were completely dead. He was almost a vegetable. A philosophy that praises that as enlightenment, I think, is a very ugly thing indeed. Christianity teaches love as the greatest virtue. But Buddhism warns, don't get too close, don't get too attached, because that will bring pain. Better if you could somehow isolate yourself and fill your head with nothing, and it wouldn't hurt so much. I don't think any of those answers works. And Jesus' answer, as we're about to come to, I think you are going to find much more unsettling than any of those, but in the end, much more satisfying. Now, all the way through this week, we're encouraging people to take away one of these Luke's Gospels. This is a first century account of the life of Jesus. We went into some detail last night about why you ought to take this seriously as a first century eyewitness document. If you missed the talk, do go on the website. You'll be able to listen to it and also hear me interview a high court judge who knows a thing or two about evidence and why he thinks this is persuasive. But for now, we're going to dive right into the middle of it on page 47. And I'd be grateful if you could follow along with me. What I want to do is to look at the teaching of Jesus in some detail on this question of suffering. And as I say, I think you're going to find it both unsettling and yet in the end profoundly comforting. I want to begin just at the bottom of page 46, where Jesus gives a clue to all he's about to say, where it says interpreting the time. Jesus also said to the crowds, when you see a cloud rising in the west, you say at once, a shower is coming, and so it happens. And when you see the south wind blowing, you said there'll be scorching heat, and it happens. You hypocrites, you know how to interpret the appearance of earth and sky, but why do you not know how to interpret the present time? So Jesus is saying to the crowds, a bit like a weather forecast, you know, red sky at night, shepherd's delight. I don't know why that is, something about the way that light's burned in the, bent in the atmosphere because of the humidity. But you can infer tomorrow's weather from the night sky. Red sky at night, shepherd's delight. Red sky in the morning, shepherd's warning. Everyone knows that. Everyone can do weather forecasting. Jesus says, well, you're good at telling the weather, but you're not very good at inferring the future from what's all around you right now. You ought to be able to read the signs and work out something about the future. That's the clue to what he's about to say about suffering. Something about the present hints at something about the future. We'll look at chapter 13. There were some present at that time who told Jesus about the Galileans whose blood Pilate had mingled with their sacrifices. So this is suffering because of human tyranny. Israel was an occupied country at that time. Roman soldiers prowled the streets. And it seems like the Roman governor, Pontius Pilate, has cracked down on a group of Jewish people, and as they're offering sacrifices to their gods, he murders them, and their blood gets mixed in with the animal blood in their sacrifices. People asked Jesus about that. He answered them, "Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the other Galileans because they suffered in this way?" In other words, Jesus, are you with the Hindus? Do you think it's all part of our karma? Is it all getting what you deserve? Jesus says, no. No. That's very important. Jesus says, if you were to line everyone in this church up on a scale with the people who've suffered the most at that end and the people who suffered the least at that end, all of us in the right order, suffering order, Jesus says that would not correlate with the people that God is most upset with and the people that God most loves. Doesn't work like that. There's not a one-to-one correspondence. Were these people worse sinners because they suffered? No. But unless you repent, you will all likewise perish. Or those 18 on whom the tower in Siloam fell and killed them. Okay, so this is suffering because of an earthquake maybe, or because of bad workmanship in the building trade. A tower collapses and 18 people die. And people report this to Jesus, ask him about it. Do you think that they were worse offenders than all the others who lived in Jerusalem? No, I tell you. But unless you repent, you will likewise perish. And he told this parable. A man had a fig tree planted in his vineyard. He came seeking fruit on it and found none. And he said to the vine dresser, "Look, for 3 years now, I've come seeking fruit on this fig tree and I find none. Cut it down. Why should it use up the ground?" And he answered him, "Sir, let it alone this year also, until I dig round it and put on manure. Then if it should bear fruit next year, well and good. But if not, you can cut it down." Here's the first point that Jesus is making about suffering. Remember, something about the present tells you something about the future. Weather forecasting. He says suffering ought to tell you that something is desperately wrong with the world. And in the future, there is going to be a judgment day. Suffering is a sign that something is desperately wrong with the world, and in the future, a judgment day. It ought to be obvious, oughtn't it? It always amazes me that the secular humanists continue to peddle a philosophy of constant evolutionary progress upwards. Everything's getting better. We're getting better, they say. Well, we're getting more sophisticated. We're getting more scientific. But the question of us getting better... No, we can do better medicines. We can do better nuclear bombs. We're just as good at killing each other. And there's just as many tears as there ever were. And suffering ought to tell us that this is not the way the world ought to be. I need to give you a bit of the backstory of the Old Testament scriptures, the Jewish scriptures before the time of Jesus. And in particular, the first three chapters of the Bible. And they go simply like this, that chapter one of the Bible, God makes the world, and the world is very good. Chapter three of the Bible, humanity rejects God, and the world gets stuffed up. And then within just a few chapters, the first murder, the first broken marriage, the first crimes, the first lies, everything begins to unravel. And it seems to me that those two things about the world make sense of our experience. The world was and is supposed to be very good, but now it's very messed up. If you took either one of those on its own, it wouldn't make sense, would it? If you said Christians believe that the world is very good, you'd say, what rose-tinted spectacles are you looking through? Have you not even read the newspaper? Ridiculous optimism. On the other hand, you could say that the world is worthless and rubbish. But that's not true either. And it's precisely the mixture of the two that makes us ask why. The world's good enough that we sense it ought to be beautiful. And yet the world's messed up enough that we wonder how it might be fixed. But just think about it for a moment. Imagine you had God's job. It was your job to be God for a day. Now, I hesitate to say that because there have been some truly awful Hollywood movies made on that premise. And I'm not suggesting you watch Bruce Almighty, it's a rubbish film. But imagine it was your job to fix the world. Because that's what we want God to do, isn't it? We say, look, God, the world's a mess. What are you going to do about it? Well, imagine that was your job. And you had to turn this messed up world into a perfect world. What would you do? Well, fairly obviously, you're going to have to get rid of all the things that mess this world up. So, for example, you're going to have to get rid of ISIS terrorists with AK-47s. Because if you have a good world, but you leave a terrorist in it, sooner or later he's going to walk into a French cinema or concert venue and murder a lot of people, and then there are going to be tears again. You can't have terrorists in a good world. And you're going to have to get rid of murderers. You're going to have to get rid of the astonishingly large number of child abusers. One of my friends is a social worker, by the way, just in case we think that we're gradually evolving upwards. A friend of mine's a social worker. She tells me that in the past, children used to be adopted because they were born out of wedlock and people were embarrassed. Now they're mainly adopted because their parents abused them. And there are more adoptions and foster cases now than there were. Just as a little barometer of how messed up our society is. You couldn't have that, could you, in a perfect world? You'd have to get rid of that. You'd have to get rid of men who beat their wives. But where would you stop? Because actually, you'd also have to get rid of people who break their promises. Because that causes lots of tears and pain. And liars, because lies hurt. and selfishness and people who scrabble to the top not caring who they trample on. And as you begin to continue the thought experiment, you realize that in order to turn this world into a perfect world, you'd have to exclude every single one of us. Because otherwise, the selfishness and the deceitfulness and the propensity to hurt people that's in my heart and yours would stuff the world up again. You would have to have a judgment day on which you ridded the world of all evil. And Jesus says there is one. You say to God, when are you going to sort the world out? And he says, soon. But please, Jesus says, take the disasters in the world, the mess of the world, as a wake-up call that something's wrong. It's not that these people were more evil than the others. It's not, as some of those awful internet hate preachers said, you know, God hates the people in Indonesia because of the tsunami. Or God's particularly anti-gay people because of the bombings or whatever it is. It doesn't work like that, Jesus says. But do you take the general point that the world's a mess? It is a world under judgment. And he says, unless you repent, the word means unless you turn back to God, turn your life around and acknowledge God, unless you do that, you will all perish on the final day. And then Jesus gives this terrifying story of the fig tree planted in a vineyard, and it's fruitless. It's a picture of the world. God's the fig tree owner. He tends the world. He provides for it. He comes along looking for fruit, and there's no fruit. It's a waste of time. So cut it down. No, he says, I'll wait one more year. I'll give people a bit more time. I'll give the opportunity that some might repent. But afterwards, cut it down. It's unsettling, isn't it? Jesus says suffering's a wake-up call. As the great British author and Oxford professor C.S. Lewis said, God whispers to us in our pleasures, but shouts to us in our sufferings. It is his megaphone to rouse a deaf world. Please don't continue in your life with this illusion that the human race is gradually progressing towards ultimate improvement and peace. There's no evidence for that. Turn on the TV, open a newspaper, and wake up to the fact that something is wrong. Jesus says, you can forecast the weather, but you need to infer from the present that there's a crisis coming. Judgment's coming. Turn the page, and I've got one paragraph more to look at, and a much happier message. Jesus was teaching in one of the synagogues on the Sabbath. That's a Saturday, which is the Jewish holy day. There was a woman there who had a disabling spirit for 18 years. Just for a moment, think about this. The last 18 years of your life, I don't know how old you are, but think of 18 years crippled. She was bent over and couldn't fully straighten herself. 18 years with some sort of paralyzing, debilitating spinal problem. When Jesus saw her, he called her over and said to her, woman, you are freed from your disability. And he laid his hands on her, and immediately she was made straight, and she glorified God. But the ruler of the synagogue, indignant because Jesus had healed on the Sabbath, said to the people, there are 6 days in which work ought to be done. Come on those days and be healed, not on the Sabbath day. And the Lord answered him, you hypocrites. Doesn't each of you on the Sabbath untie his ox or his donkey from the manger and lead it away to water it? And ought not this woman, a daughter of Abraham, whom Satan bound for 18 years, be loosed from this bond on the Sabbath day? As he said these things, all his adversaries were put to shame, and all the people rejoiced at all the glorious things that were done by him. We've seen that suffering is a sign that something's wrong, and the world is under judgment. We must repent. But Jesus' power to end suffering is a sign that he can fix the world, and we should trust him. Jesus' power over suffering is a sign that he can fix the world, and we should trust him. Now, during Jesus' life, I invited people yesterday, and I invite you today, to read this book and look for two kinds of evidence. Look for the evidence of what the eyewitnesses reported, and look for the evidence of whether Jesus fits the prophecies made many hundreds of years before. And we see both those bits of evidence in this paragraph. Jesus does various miracles in front of eyewitnesses. In this case, here's a woman who has some sort of spiritual attack. Jesus ascribes it to Satan. It's not that he's superstitious and he thinks all illness is an evil spirit. Actually, Luke is a doctor and makes quite careful distinctions in his gospel between various kinds of medical ailments and demonic ailments. It seems this one is a sort of combination of the two. She's had a spirit for 18 years, which has manifested itself in these spinal aberrations. But Jesus touches her and does what no physio could do. In 1 second, she's perfectly well. Now, what I want you to notice in terms of the eyewitness evidence is that even Jesus' opponents grant that he does it. That's very interesting for me. They don't say, oh, it was faked, or, you know, she's just a stooge, or, you paid her as an actress. They know, presumably, they live in the same town. They've seen her for 18 years hobbling over. They recognize her. They know it happened. They are just annoyed that Jesus does it on the wrong day of the week, which I know is slightly bizarre for us to understand. But even his opponents grant the miracle. And the same is true of many, many other miracles in this book. You can read about them. Jesus raising people from the dead. Jesus healing people who are blind. In front of witnesses, sometimes hostile witnesses. Their quibble is difficult for us to understand, but basically the Jewish law said that for 6 days you were to work, but on the Sabbath day you were to rest from your work. And it was an opportunity to take a day of rest, to remember God as the creator of the world, and to remember the goal to which the world was headed. That one day God brought his creative work to completion and enjoyed it and rested in a perfectly completed world. In fact, it came from the very beginning of the Bible, when God made a world that was good. Before it got stuffed up, there was a Sabbath. God enjoyed, what a beautiful world I've made. Well, Jewish people were supposed to, one day a week, take a day off from work and think about the perfect world. Now, there's a great irony here, and I wonder if you can spot it. The synagogue ruler gets very annoyed at Jesus for healing on the Sabbath, and he accuses him of basically breaking the law and doing some work, which is a bit rich for a couple of reasons. Firstly, Jesus doesn't exactly spend the whole day in the intensive care ward. He just touches a woman. I mean, it's not very difficult for Jesus to do this. And secondly, it's completely two-faced, because Jesus knows that the synagogue ruler is perfectly happy to give his a dog a bowl of water on a Saturday rather than waiting in the Middle Eastern sun until the Sunday to do so. So for goodness sake, you look after your animals on a Saturday, and I'm not allowed to heal a woman by touching her after 18 years of suffering? For goodness sake. But as I say, it is ironic, because actually, far from being the day on which Jesus ought to do it, the Sabbath is the most appropriate day of the week for this miracle to occur. The Sabbath was the day that Jewish people remembered that when God made the world, he completed it, and it was perfectly good. And they began to look forward to a day that God would again fix the world, sort it out, and it would be perfectly rescued, perfectly fixed. What better day for Jesus to offer the proof that he can fix the world than on the day that every Jewish person is supposed to look forward to the fixing of the world? On the Sabbath. Now, of course, Jesus doesn't fix every disease. He didn't even do it in his day. There were hospitals with people left in them when Jesus died and rose again and went up to heaven. He didn't cure all illness. Jesus doesn't cure all cancer. We've heard the good news from Sarah, but in a few weeks' time at St. Helens, we'll be hearing the currently bad news of one of the city's top bankers. He's a Christian. His diagnosis is terminal. And early this year, I took a funeral of a very close friend who was a member of the congregation here because she died in her 40s of cancer. God doesn't sort out every disease now. But the fact that Jesus, before eyewitnesses, sorted out some is a sign. It's a pointer. It's not an empty claim. If he were to come along and said, don't worry, I'm the Messiah, I can make everything okay again, you'd think, oh, wishful thinking. But if someone comes into the world and says, don't worry, I'm the Messiah, I can fix the world. For example, you're blind, now you can see. You've been crippled for 18 years, but I touch you and you're free. Your daughter's dead. We looked at this last night. Your daughter's dead, but I'm telling you she's asleep. And they laugh with contempt at him until he takes her by the hand and she walks up, she gets up and walks around. They're astonished. And Jesus puts his money where his mouth is. He proves that he can do it. And then at the very end of this gospel, we get the worst suffering and the greatest hope. I almost want to not give you the spoiler because I want you to read it. But suffice it to say that at the end of this book, Jesus gets himself killed and he faces the worst suffering. But 3 days later, he breaks through death and is resurrected. And as Sarah said, as a thinking engineer and scientist, there's all sorts of evidence for it. We'll look at some of that on Sunday if you're able to join us. But the very last page says this: thus is written that the Christ should suffer and on the third day rise from the dead, and that repentance and forgiveness of sins should be proclaimed in his name to all nations, beginning from Jerusalem. You are witnesses of these things. Atheism, suffering's meaningless. There's nothing to say. There's nothing I could say. It's just random numbers. Hinduism, suffering is payback. Do you think that these Galileans were worse sinners than all the others? Well, they must have been. Must have been karma, getting what they deserved. Buddhism, suffering is because of unwanted attachments. If only we could detach ourselves. Those 18 who died when the Tower of Siloam fell on them, Jesus says, don't worry about them. Just go into your room and meditate and forget about all the horrible things. I don't think those are very satisfying answers. Here's Jesus' answer. Wake up. Suffering is a sign that this world has gone terribly wrong. It's under God's judgment. And unless you repent, unless you turn round, you too will perish. Very unsettling. But then words of great comfort. Jesus' ability to do the miraculous is a sign that he can fix this world if we trust him. Now, thanks for listening. Thanks for hearing these things. Thanks for considering the Christian response to suffering. I want you to think about this more. And I said this last night, I'm going to say it again. And this is an invitation to consider carefully the claims of Jesus. We've just looked at one chapter together. And I hope you agree, he's got some quite profound things to say in just three paragraphs. But there's a whole book here of Jesus' teaching. I would love you to do the responsible thing and take the time to engage with it as a thinking adult. And here's my suggestion. This is yours to take away. You could read the whole thing in about 2 hours. But I'm going to suggest that you don't do that. Instead, you take 1 hour to read the first chapter. I mean, you don't need to do it that slowly, but I'm suggesting you do it that slowly. Read it slowly enough to actually think about what's being said, a bit like we did with chapter 13. And as you read it, why not scribble on it, annotate it? These are yours to take away. So why not tick everything you agree with, but across against anything you disagree with, and underline anything that you don't understand? And then find a Christian, perhaps the Christian who brought you, or if you came on your own, come and see me. I'll be happy to do this. And the Christian will buy you a coffee. I'm offering on their behalf. And you can go through the annotations of chapter 1. You can say, I like this, I didn't really like that, I didn't understand this. And maybe the Christian can shed some light on it, maybe not. And if that's a useful experience, then you can do the same for chapter 2. Another coffee the Christian will buy. And there's a maximum of 24 coffees in this book. But if it's not useful, then you just do one chapter and one coffee, and then you say, look, to be honest, this wasn't very helpful, and we'll leave it there. So it's kind of no commitment. All you've got to lose is 1 hour of your life and one coffee. But potentially 24 coffees, and more importantly, potentially hope, real hope, in a world of cancer, a world of suffering. Real answers. Please do that. There's 4 different eyewitness biographies of Jesus in the New Testament. Matthew, Mark, Luke and John. This is number 3, Luke. It might be the Christian friend that's brought you has a... at this church, we study Mark's gospel for some of us. Others of us have studied John's gospel. It might be they know one of those better and they prefer that because they could give you slightly more informed help. And we've got some other gospels on the way out. But either way, grab one of them. It doesn't really matter which. And why not read chapter 1 with your friend? Have a coffee. I'd love you to do that. I'd love you to take this seriously enough to engage with it. We'd also love to invite you back tomorrow. Tomorrow I'll be interviewing an Oxford professor who is an expert in the history of race relations, and in particular the black civil rights movement and the history of racial oppression in the West. So things like the Black Lives Matter, some of the recent racial tensions in the US. He is the world expert on it. He's also a Christian. His hope is that the Christian message is the answer to disunity and racial harmony. I think it'll be really fascinating. And I'll be speaking on the way in which Jesus brings about acceptance and inclusion and transformation. Please come if you can tomorrow night. Please join us on Sunday. We'll be looking at, in more detail, at the resurrection of Jesus, the evidence for it, and what it means for us. We're meeting in here at 10:30, 4 o'clock, and 6 o'clock. And finally, all of this material will be on the website. I think some of it's already gone up from yesterday. You can download it and watch it again, have a think about it. Thank you so much for coming. I'm very grateful for your time.